Let's go.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Tapp, and this is the DNA of Purpose podcast, where we explore purpose as a part of who we already are. We showcase all inspiring stories of the most purpose-driven people on the planet with the intention of giving you the tools to step into the potential of who you were always born to be. After all, it's in your DNA. Welcome to another episode of the DNA of Purpose podcast. A few weeks ago, a friend of mine and a colleague at Future Crunch, the lovely Amy, sent me a book saying that I just had to have the author of this book on today's podcast. And after having a read through the book, I wholeheartedly agreed. Our guest today is Dr. Tyson Uchenporter, and this book is called Sand Talk: How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. Now, when I picked up the book, I was excited for two reasons. Firstly, of all of the incredible people I have spoken to throughout the course of this podcast, I was yet to interview a voice representing the innate wisdom and knowledge of Australia's Indigenous peoples. The other reason is I guess, a little more personal. As someone who's spent much of the last 15 years decoding what makes a personal message influential, I always find it fascinating to talk to people who have found a niche area of specialization that somehow bridges the gap between two completely different worlds. And in doing so, they are able to create new stories and new perspectives. And in the case of Tyson, this perspective, I think, has the power to provide the solutions that humankind needs at this point in history, more so than ever before. Tyson has certainly done, I think, a really great job of translating that space in between. And yet at the same time, despite today being a thought-provoking change maker, I have to say he's so humble, authentic, and his approach is so grounded and pragmatic. So who is he? Tyson belongs to the Apalet clan from Western Cape York and is a senior lecturer in Indigenous knowledge at Deakin University. He has worked extensively with Aboriginal languages and in Indigenous education, and his research activities include oral histories of natural disasters, language, health and cognition. He is also a published poet and exhibited artist who practices traditional wood carving. Quite a multi-talented person. In his book, Sand Talk: How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World, he covers everything from echidnas to evolution, cosmology to cooking, sex and science. And the book also explores how line symbols and shapes can help us to make sense of the world. And we do dive into that subject in detail. We also chatted about the feasibility of Indigenous thinking as a solution to modern world problems like climate change. We discussed the chasm between ancient Indigenous ways of life and the contemporary world. And we also explored why, as Australians, some of us look to Indigenous people as cultural confetti at events, as opposed to wise mentors and advisors who can ultimately help us save the planet. So, as always, kick back, strap in, and get ready to dive in to the application of ancient wisdom with a future focus with the one and only Dr. Tyson Uchenporter. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast, Dr. Tyson Uchenporter. It is such a pleasure to have you here.
Hey, yeah, it's good to be here. Yeah, I don't often hear doctor. That's just, I mostly only use that for references for references for relatives and affidavits and stuff like that. That's when I put doctor.
Well, I will drop the doctor from here on in.
That's charming and refreshing.
Well, look, as a starting point, it feels appropriate to start with an acknowledgement of country. But before doing that, I wanted to actually ask you, what is the significance of an acknowledgement of country? And given we are now doing all of these podcasts and playing in all of these virtual lands, how do we do an acknowledgement of country in the most respectful way?
Yeah, well, I think most people tend to, everybody just sort of acknowledges where they are, where they're coming in from. But I mean, you know, there's more questions that we need to deal with. Like, do we need to, or should we be acknowledging country from where the server is that's making the signal? You know, it's, yeah, anyway. But I mean, I think mostly acknowledgement of country is moving towards some kind of, being some kind of verbal contract.
Yeah.
You know, between people.
Yeah.
You know, for that they, you know, they are acknowledging that the laws of the land and that, you know, while living and working or visiting in that place, that they will be, you know, doing their best to honor the laws of the land there.
Yeah.
And to respect the place and all that sort of thing. Yeah. So I see it as a verbal contract more than anything else.
Okay, beautiful. Mm. Well, here is my verbal contract. I acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation on the land in which I sit today, and I believe you are in Melbourne.
Yes, I'm in Naam. Naam's the name of this traditionally, this place, N-A-A-R-M. Yeah, this is, I'm currently in my fourth tour of Naam. Now with... yeah, I think this is my fourth year here.
Yeah.
I've got a couple more to go and then I can go back home, which is 3,500 kilometres to the north of here. Yeah.
Gosh, I look forward to hearing a little more about that in a minute. Tyson, given the nature of this podcast, I get to speak with quite, you know, some of the most purpose-driven people on the planet. And because of that, I'm always interested to ask my guests if there's any one idea, trend or tool that you've stumbled across or that you've been pondering that you believe will significantly influence the creation of a better future.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I've been talking for a long time about, you know, something I've observed in... what happens to communities of people during and immediately after a disaster, like a natural disaster, when the controls of state and marketplace are temporarily disrupted and people sort of for a while get back to doing what our human patterning is all about, which is, you know, cooperation and collaboration, you know, for sort of mutual abundance and support, you know.
Yeah.
And you see a lot, like a lot of people, even if they've lost everything, a lot of people are weirdly in this state of extreme happiness and like they're just the best days of their life. Mm. And they always think back on them fondly. It's really weird. You even see that with a lot of 9/11 stories, you know.
And is that because you believe it resets those patterns, like we connect back to what's really important?
Yeah, well, it's just like for a moment with all of the illusions and controls temporarily removed, I just think people get back to it. And that gives me hope to know that human beings as a species have not lost that. It's the same as a bird that's bred in captivity and then released and it just knows the migration routes.
Mm.
You know, I sort of I'm glad that we still have that racial memory as a species, which is pretty exciting. But a few people have contacted me and said, you know, that's called mutual aid activism, like what you're talking about there.
It's a thing.
Yeah, it's a thing. Yeah, if you look up pretty much wherever you are, you can look up mutual aid activist sort of networks that are, you know, how you got like crisis capitalism and vulture capitalism where they always leverage a disaster to do massive wealth transfers and land grabs and stuff. Well, it seems like, you know, the people at the grassroots have sort of started leveraging disasters for, you know, our own human needs and the needs of the land and communities and all things good.
Mm.
And it just seems to be quite a global phenomenon that's just, and it's emergent. It's got no leaders or bosses or... you know, ideologies or gurus or anything like that, which is probably why most people haven't heard of it. It's just something that we're doing.
Well, it's an evolutionary bias, isn't it? To need each other to come into tribe.
That's it. Mm. So at the same time as we have like a time of massive social fragmentation and a loss of faith in institutions and some of the worst discourse practices, you know, of human beings and massive amounts of bullying and gaslighting and just horrendous stuff there, a complete breakdown in human relationships everywhere. At the same time as that's happening, this is happening. Mm. But this is something that creation does. There's always a seesaw.
Absolutely.
You can't tip too far one way without something else happening on the other side.
I was looking at the sand talk image you did about creation, and we will talk about that more in a minute, but I think you had referenced in the book this whole idea of collapse and renewal, that while one thing is collapsing, there is renewal on the other side, and you're almost pointing towards that here.
Yeah. Oh, completely. Mm. Look, and you know, and I reference also in that book about, you know, how many apocalypses we have been through. You know, like just here, our people, heaps of apocalypses. We've got dreaming stories about all of them, and they're confirmed in the geological record, you know. So it's in our oral histories, all of these massive apocalypses. And, you do all right through them. You come out the other side and you actually have a fair bit of fun along the way. And it's kind of, I don't know, it's something that brings you joy, that sort of collective problem solving in difficult circumstances. Mm. I did read about, you know, that Lord of the Flies book that everyone has to read.
Yes, I do.
You know, when they start high school, just to like induct them into the game theory nightmare that they're about to enter in the marketplace. You know, it's like, oh, humans are inherently selfish, and if we dropped all these boys for some reason on an island, you know, inevitably they're going to turn savage and start killing each other and wreck the joint, and it'll all be on fire because that's what humans do. It's the selfish gene and all that sort of thing, you know, and that coming out of all the anthropology of the 70s and the 60s was all about backing up that. Well, the stuff done by males anyway, you know, but I read an article about, you know, a story of actual boys. They were about the same age as you are when you're forced to read that book at school. Actually, actual boys who would drop who got stuck for a year and a half on a rock in the middle of the ocean. And when they were picked up, and they were very, very healthy and very, very happy and just with absolute lifelong bonds.
Yeah.
And they just established this amazing, you know, culture on that place. It was just, you know, a dozen boys together on an island, and they, you know, they were really quite organized and collaborative. And, you know, even though for the first 6 months before they'd got their systems in place, their resources were very scarce. Just through that kind of sharing and caring for each other, they were able to, you know, they healed their broken bones and did all kinds of stuff and just thrived. Absolutely thrived. And that's what you do.
Yeah.
Even if you're stuck on a barren rock in the middle of the ocean, humans are pretty damn good at thriving together.
And whilst we will dive into this today, I imagine one of the most beautiful things about Indigenous thinking is that it is remembering who we really are, and that we are innately a connected species. And it's so interesting that counterintuitively, at least in the West, we have built this society that asks us to be the complete opposite of that.
I don't think we've built it as human beings. We haven't built this civilization. These are things that have been built on top of us and on top of our lands as human beings. And we're forced to inhabit those. In the same way that the ghost cities in China have been built on top of villages. And the villagers now, you know, have to live in camps on the outside of these empty cities. And their job now is to sweep those streets every day because all their lands have been destroyed, so they can't do their farming, subsistence farming anymore, and survive that way. So they get paid a pittance and get bad food just to sweep the streets. I mean, that's all we're doing. We're doing labor for these civilizations that have been built on top of our lands. Now, that group of boys I was telling you about on that island, This is an exclusive for me. I've never talked to anyone about it before.
Love that.
But it's huge.
Got the grab.
So I'll keep it just for you.
That sounds great.
The other thing is not just connectedness together, but connectedness with place. They actually, them being on that island was good for the island. It regenerated, you know, an island that was basically, you know, it was dying, because I think it was 100 years before that it was inhabited, and the indigenous people from there were taken, everybody, man, woman, and child. Every single person was taken from that island and taken as slaves. And so it was completely empty. And there were just a few remnant sort of species left over there from, you know, like their chickens. So you had, if you imagine how chickens would evolve wild on a bare rock over 100 years, and, you know, some sort of feral banana plants, a couple of coconut trees, and, you know, a few root vegetables like taro and things like that. And, you know, but those have just sort of gone feral. But the boys being there and caring for that place and really, really coming into a close relation with that entity, that spirit of place, of that island, they, you know, all of their ritual activities, everything they did on that island was caring for it. You know, and they were there, and they did made increase happen within that system, and they, you know, filled the ecological niche that humans fill in systems, and actually really made it a vibrant and lush and living place that had almost turned into complete just wasteland. I think that's a wonderful story. I think that's the real Lord of the Flies. Lord of the Flies, the real story is that there is no Lord. You know, there's just flies. You know, you increase, you fertilize the place,
yeah,
and look after the place, and you care for your little maggots, and that's how it works. And it's pretty easy, and it's lots of fun, and, you know, it'd be nice for us all to have a chance to get back to that at some stage.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, the symbiotic utopia. Which I'm sure we'll explore the how that could possibly happen over the course of maybe the next few questions. Tyson, today we're here to dive into your amazing book, which I went through. I want to go back and read it front to back, but I did about 2 or 3 hours of research yesterday, and I just want to spend more time with this book because, you know, it was amazing. It is called Sand Talk: How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. As I said, I'm excited to be diving in today, but before moving into your story and the wisdom of the book, I'm curious to understand what Sand Talk is. And from an Indigenous perspective, it would be great if you could give our listeners an overview of how lines and symbols and shapes help us to make sense of the world.
I think it's something that most humans have done in most places. You know, that idea of sketching ideas out on the ground, you know, in a sort of an informal everyday thing. And it's different in every place. Even in Australia, across different language groups, all the different tribes, there's different practices. You know, in some places, only women are allowed to do it and men don't do it at all, kind of thing. But then there's the bigger ceremonial stuff, and it's a bit like when you see those Eastern mystics doing, you know, mandalas, and, you know, in Tibet where they do those big sand sort of images.
Yep, the sand mandalas,
And the whole idea is, you know, that it's ephemeral. It's wonderful. It exists for a short time for the purposes of the ritual, but then it has to be wiped away. And I think that's the important thing with Sand Talk. It's I don't know. So with most of your thinking and abstraction and theory, that's sort of done in an abstract space. So, you know, I talk about that in the book, that process of taking tangible things in the real world and translating those into metaphors, because metaphors, the language of spirit. So you translate it into metaphors across in that abstract space or that spirit space. And then you do things with those metaphors there, you know, different combinatorials, and you make new patterns with that. But then you you bring that, you've got to close the loop and bring that back into the tangible world and translate that back into the reality. Mm. And that's how ceremony works. That's how all knowledge work, you know, through most of human history has worked. That's how knowledge has been done. But there's something when you're working with images, the reason why they should be temporary is because you're not doing that work of taking it across into the spirit world and then and then bringing it back. You're actually doing that spirit work over here in the tangible reality. So it's very, very powerful. Mm. An image is a very, very powerful thing. So in a lot of our languages, the word for image is the same as the word for spirit. So there's that idea where, you know, if you take a photo of somebody, then that's part of their spirit there. So if you can imagine what what it is now for everyone in the world to have their images online being replicated
into infinity. Well, it's a part of you, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, every image of you, it's not just one image. That's replicated infinitely in the cloud. So what does that do to your spirit?
Yeah.
You know, so we have that. Some my clan does sculptures, animal sculptures, like dog sculptures and things like this. And you know, the old fellas say that they're very much losing their power now because we've made too many of them.
Yeah.
Because they have a really strong market niche, like internationally. You know, people love those dog sculptures and they'll pay like 10 grand for them. Mm. So there's quite a few in the world now.
But it's like diluting the energy, is it?
Yeah. Well, look, originally the ceremony for that is around you make one sculpture and you use it for that ceremony.
Yep.
And then afterwards that's finished. Mm. It's made for the ceremony and then it's done, you know. But then, but now they're objet.
Yeah.
You know, these are products. And so, you know, that image gets replicated, you know, many times, and it takes from the dreaming of that entity, that spirit, and weakens it. Yeah. I mean, it used to be that, you know, because there would only be one image of that image would be so powerful that children would have to be prepared if they were coming anywhere near it.
Yeah.
In certain ways, you'd have to put your smell on them because the image would make them sick. Mm. It was that powerful, the spirit emanating from that. But now it's fine. Kids can walk up to it, touch it, pick it up.
Yeah.
They don't get sick.
They don't
anymore.
Get that. Yeah.
You know, because that spirit's diluted through replication. Yeah. And I think that's a really good definition for digital technology.
It's such an interesting concept. And I mean, it explains so much with regards to how digitization has impacted our mental health and that literally that energy drain we can experience if we spend too much time there. And there's just so much in this metaphor to explore with regards to how we go about navigating the modern world.
Yeah, that's it.
Tyson, I'm darting around a little bit with my questions here, but I want to ask you this question now because I think it directly dovetails from what you were just talking about there. I want to wander into the concept of dream time and the stories of the sky, the stars, the planets. And in the book, if you don't mind me sharing your words, you said this: "The moment is not just about celestial bodies forming an orderly queue. It is also about 1,000 different stories that converge and the pattern they create in a dialogue between Earth, sky, and me. The way each person knows these stories is subjective. How they are known in that time and place by that person is a unique viewpoint that is sacred. A communication between Earth camp and sky camp, between people and a sentient cosmos." Now, what strikes me about these words is the sense of sacred union between one life and all of life, and the notion that nothing is a coincidence, that we will somehow find ourselves in the right place at the right time in order to translate the story that is meant for us. In your opinion, if we are seeking to create a more beautiful world at this point in human history, do you think we need to open our minds to what might be considered more soulful, a more soulful perspective, alongside the science and the systems that we study and we understand?
Well, I think people forget that science is spiritual.
Mm.
You know, everything is. I don't know many science. I mean, if you use that term, they'll wince,
mm.
you know, and they'll avoid it. But if you don't actually, you know, talk, if you're not talking directly about the importance of spirituality to them, which will make them immediately roll their eyes because they know where that's going, that's going to some weird pseudoscience and somebody's grift that they're using to sell, I don't know, bleach to people for COVID or,
mm.
you know, a new line of tie-dyed belly ring pendants or something. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just, it's always a grift and it's always made up and not, it's not something that people have found in spirit or through any real practice. It's always rubbish and it has no rigor. And there's so much of it out there that I think scientists, well, the scientific community that, you know, I've been in dialogue with, it, they're very much on their guard for that stuff. Mm. Because it pollutes the space of inquiry. And, you know, my old people are just as strict about that nonsense too.
Mm.
You know, it's it pollutes things. It destroys things, you know, and I don't know. We always have to be careful when we're in dialogue with other people because you never know what they're going to want to take away and, you know, sort of airbrush and take the stink of the place off it and the stink of spirit and then turn it into like, you know, spirituality or, you know, like mindfulness as opposed to a, you know, a mystical tradition that's, that, you know, and initially was a, you know, basically a, you know, the ideology of an uprising against Hindu fascism, you know what I mean? And that was, you know, of place and that was deeply embedded in spirit and was highly rigorous and it's just been just wrecked and now it all fits on a PDF document that they send you when you're, I don't know, thinking of killing yourself in the workplace, you know?
Yep.
You've got to be productive. Yeah, I just think it's science is spiritual. You know, they have to be guarded against, you know, grifters and, you know, people out for a fast buck through Christ or whatever.
Yep.
You've got to look out for that. And, yeah, and so that's why you don't actually say the word there. But they're as spiritual as hell. And, you know, you look, you know, even evolutionary biologists will acknowledge that there is some kind of force multiplier there. There is some kind of, you know, increase mechanism. That their theory has not yet, you know, been able to explain that there's something in there,
something magical.
Yeah. When push comes to shove, they end up, you know, just quietly telling you, yeah, there is something else pretty magical in there that, that makes that big leap from a bloody, you know, this kind of animal to a completely different kind of animal. Mm. It's, you know, in a pretty damn short time, actually. And it's usually a lot of variables acting together, but you know, what is it that's creating that dance and that pattern of, all those different agents interacting and creating these co-evolutionary pressures, you know, this epigenetic sort of, you know, magic that's happening and that's acting on us all, you know, it's just, you know, it's there's a certain awe and reverence that I find, you know, in scientists, and they, you know, all of their origin stories are all like, you know, eureka moments and stuff like this, and you know, apples falling from trees, and you know, guy takes a bath and, and suddenly runs naked down the street. You know, it's not, I mean, it's a fairly ecstatic practice. Historically, science. So yeah, I've got heaps of respect for science as a particular culture's body of knowledge, and as a kind of an international sort of collaboration, which it has been from the start.
So I want to jump back in time with you. I know that today you're an author, academic, educator, Indigenous thinker, artist, researcher, and poet. I'm curious to know, how did a young boy belonging to the Apalach clan from Western Cape York become a translator of ancient Indigenous wisdom for the modern world? Can you share with me a little bit about those formative years of your life?
Yeah, well, it's just you come to that through, you know, massive disruption and
Yes, it's true.
I just, it's weird. So sort of being displaced and disrupted and disconnected and reconnected and then smashed again and again and all that sort of stuff. It's just I think that sort of puts you in a place where you. I don't know. I think anybody who's lived through abuse gets very good at seeing the perspectives of other people because it's a survival mechanism, you know. You have to completely be able to inhabit the position and the ontology of an abuser or a bully because that's your survival depends on that. You're constantly trying to anticipate what they're doing next. So I think that gives you pretty good predictive skills and actually quite a bit of empathy. It's
Oh,
a skill
absolutely.
set that you can't learn through a course.
Yeah.
And I guess being really mobile and being moved around from lots and lots of places, mostly in Queensland, remote locations, remote communities. And all that sort of thing. I think you learn how to come into dialogue with new places really quickly as well, and make those connections to place, and just do what you need to do to keep being human, and just hang on to a bit of that. I think that's how it works.
Yeah, and I know just through, flicking through the front pages of the book that one of the struggles you went through was around making sense of your biracial background in a world that seemingly wanted you to be black or white. Do you mind sharing with me a little bit about that in terms of your own personal journey?
Yeah, well, it always seems to be, I don't know, that people want you to be, I mean, black when it's to their advantage
Yeah.
and want to deny that when it's not, kind of thing. But I don't know, you can only just be you.
Yep.
And I don't know, the kind of all the categories that people have,
Yeah, all the
like
labels.
race itself, which doesn't really exist, but then stuff like biracial and all that sort of stuff, it's not really how you see yourself when you look in the mirror. It's but it is, it is really, I don't know, that's really awful too,
Yep.
there's physical abuse, but then that abuse is really like, I survived a lot of really horrendous things. But I almost didn't survive that as an adult.
Yep.
Like as a young sort of adult.
I have to ask, has that informed your purpose today? Because I imagine that experience would really assist you in terms of translating Indigenous knowledge into Western systems and patterns and looking at those connections.
It's also though like a constant navigation, like and negotiation of I don't know, because it's not just. You can get carried away with this idea that you're expressing yourself,
Yeah.
and but you're not. You're in dialogue with the world, who's they're going to hear things that you say, and they're going to make their own meaning of that. So I don't know. I kind of try and be careful with what I'm saying,
Yep.
because people want to, people want to paint you this way or that way. They have this. I don't know, they come up with an idea of who you are based on their sort of essentialized views of what is in the world. And then everything comes through that lens and, a completely different message from what you put out there ends up going into their heads. And the worst thing is you're kind of responsible for that
Yeah.
because you're the one who put this bloody unfiltered, unguarded, words into the world. And that's not how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to be accountable for your word.
And intentional. Yeah.
Yeah, it's I don't know, it's been quite distressing. I like I don't know, the book was only ever supposed to be a small thing. It was from a small publisher. They said, we might end up doing 5,000 copies if we're really lucky, kind of thing. And so I kind of wrote it with a small audience in mind and wrote it quite intimately, thinking, oh yeah, I can manage those relationships. And yeah, but then it's sort of COVID came along and people want answers.
Well, and yeah, and I think suddenly the relevance of this message is huge. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Suddenly there's a market niche for Indigenous wisdom because it's like, help.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's kind of like, you know, gone out into the world and I can do it myself. I can do it myself. I don't need the earth. I don't need the mother. I'm getting out there. I'm going to do my own thing. And everything went wrong. And it's all dying. And we're going to die. And now everybody's running home to mum like, mum, mum, help me. Help me. And so that's, you know, First Nations, basically.
So let's talk about that, because there was a paragraph that caught my eye in the book where you were talking about the paradox of living the city life in Melbourne versus living by the principles and the practices of the Indigenous way of life. And so I guess I'm curious to understand how you personally reconcile that, but it actually got me thinking more broadly about what it would really take to use and implement Indigenous thinking to change the world. Now, to give that context, much of the Western world is kind of still anchored in the notion that I am and that I exist because I think, whereas Indigenous knowledge suggests that I am and that I exist because I am located, because I have place. Mm. Now, these are two distinctly different worldviews. So how do you suggest we begin to bridge the chasm between these systems? Can we choose both?
I think all the best we can hope for is a culture of transition for a century or two, you know?
Yeah.
And like I said, it's, I don't know, it's in you anyway.
Mm.
Everyone on the planet's born exactly the same.
Mm.
So, you know, you could have, you know, a Kalahari Bushman baby, like born in the desert straight into that way of life, you know. And that baby is exactly the same as, you know, a baby born in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Sort of swaddled and...
Baby Joe,
you know,
blog.
Staying on the top floor of a really high building.
Yep.
In a crappy little apartment. You know, they're exactly the same. They're exactly the same being at that stage. Everybody's born the same way, you know. And, you know, we kind of get twisted as we go along. You know, from our experiences, and but I really feel like it's not impossible to expect, like, a, you know, a return. It's even this idea of a rite of return, you know, which I borrowed from another culture. You know, it's like, you know, we have a right to at least be beginning to try and return to that. But you know, it's going to be a while. There are a lot of you know, there's a lot of baggage that's going to come along, and it does. But that's what happens after apocalypse, is it takes a while, you know, for the new, it takes a while for the homeostasis to happen, and you can't expect to arrive there before the land does.
Yeah, you've just got to be comfortable
to do together
in the space, you know, in between.
Yeah, we basically, we've got, if we can get through the next two decades, then we've got a 1,000-year cleanup ahead of us.
Yeah.
And our human cultures in that time will have to be cultures of transition, because the world, you know, will be just in this complete state of hysteresis and flux. And we're going to have to move with it while that's happening. We're going to have to be prepared to be mobile. You're going to have to be prepared to put in a little bit more than we're taking out for a while as well, you know?
Yeah, rebalance things.
And that's not a healthy way to live. That's how I'm living in this city now. Like, I'm, because of what's happened with Santalk, and I'm accountable for that word, I'm having to put in about 100 times more than I'm getting out.
Including this podcast. Probably,
yeah, I've put a time limit on that for a few more years, like 3 years, I think, 2-3 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, but then it is killing me to do this work.
Mm.
It's, you know, it's, yeah, it's 20-hour days.
Yeah.
And it's 7 days a week, and it just never bloody stops. You know, and I'm not being in the world.
Yeah.
You know, at all. And that's really dangerous, to be that profoundly disconnected and to be trying to speak from a memory of connection.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it allows me to inhabit more easily the sort of, if I'm sharing a disconnected reality with the disconnected people I'm talking to.
Mm.
And there is a kind of a solidarity and a sort of belongingness in that as well. We sort of have a shared pathology, And I think that's why the book's done well, because, you know, I'm a bit sort of batshit crazy. I think they call it, you know, neurally divergent or something, you know, and it's not a sort of a typical, you know, most of the Indigenous people you talk to who are thinkers and, you know, who are sort of spokespeople, you know, for land and for people, these are very dignified, very measured, you know, solemn, awesome people. And I don't know, I think it's just been, it's been nice for people to have like, to mix it up a bit and just to be able to, you know, exchange information with somebody who's, you know, who's not, who's not perfect, who's not like, you know, amazing and accomplished and, you know, wise. Yeah, I think it's cool to engage with Indigenous thinking with somebody who's, who has absolutely no wisdom at all and is just, is as terrified and mixed up and messed up as everybody
and
else.
And I actually loved that about your book because, you know, it only took me two or three pages. You have a level of authenticity and a humility that is so raw and real, and there's like no BS, that it just, it made you so likable. Like you had me at hello in that sense going through the book because of that approach to the wisdom that you're offering. But I think the other thing that you did was really clever is you took Indigenous thinking and ancient wisdom and applied it across an entirely new lens, which is that of the future and of the current problems we're facing. And that brings me to one of my next, I guess, talking points, because one of the problems that you actually highlighted is that some of us are still treating Indigenous thinking as nice to have kind of cultural confetti rather than really viewing these systems as real, measurable and like future focused solutions. And that's interesting because whilst on one hand you've got your corporate organisation celebrating, you know, diversity and collaboration and innovation, there still seems to be this unconscious bias that is inhibiting us from seeing these really, you know, very real solutions that have been here longer than we have. What would it take for that narrative to flip? Because that's really not working.
Yeah, I guess people who get it, who get that and the narrative flips for them, are people who have the capacity to understand the difference between process and content.
Yeah.
You know, I think people get things mixed up. They get mixed up between, you know, what is data and what is knowledge. You know, most people are operating at the data level of things. You know, they just get one bite, you know, one bit, and then that they think is knowledge, and that they've gained something. But knowledge is a process. You know, knowledge is a method of inquiry. So that's Indigenous knowledge. That's everybody's knowledge. So, you know, in the same way science is a method of inquiry, you know, Indigenous knowledge systems are driven by the same thing. And it's funny, it's exactly the same thing, that baby born in South Africa and that baby born in Scotland. I said before, you know, they're both born as these little inquiry machines. You are born, you know, to seek these, you know, heuristics of meaning making and understanding and you know, the process of knowledge, you know, to make sense of the world, you know, collectively with other people. That's what you do. And all human beings do that. And really just, you know, engaging with Indigenous knowledge, you won't want to take anything or appropriate anything, or, you know, you won't need to, like, can I have a feather? You know, you won't need that anymore, you know, if you're engaging at the level of process, because you really are just igniting your own human processes and then finding, well, what's going to be my pattern of inquiry? What is going to be, how am I going to verify and falsify things? How am I going to triangulate, polyangulate, you know, to ensure that I'm not getting sucked into a cult, or I'm not starting a cult.
Yes, exactly.
You know, read the book again, Jesus. Yeah, like, so some people are capable of seeing the difference between process and content and to go, yep, it's in the verb, not in the noun. Too deadly. You know, And I don't know, that's a sexy idea that's getting around in the world right now. The idea of, you know, noun-based languages. A lot of modern languages are noun-based, whereas a lot of your more ancient, languages, the ones that aren't vast monocultures, you know, with these big trade creoles like French and English and German and stuff like that, that have developed as a response to sort of unifying millions of people under one sort of nation-building purpose. You need a noun-based language for that. And that means that your statistical methods, the way you quantify things, are about quantifying nouns, things that have a noun attached to them.
Yep.
And so therefore, you know, your economics, your framework for economics, that becomes something that's focused on things rather than processes and relationships. So you're no longer capable of tracking processes and relationships, or of assigning value to that. So the technology is not there for assigning a quantitative value to, a process or a relation or a place.
Or of integrating the symbology you were talking about before. I can't help but think of your reference earlier to the shapes, the lines, the symbology and the stories. It kind of feels like those languages, because they're only focused on that top-level data, are not accounting for the process that is symbology and the integration of those messages and that meaning.
Well, that symbology, that's how you, quantify, analyze, collect data. You know, it's part of your process of inquiry, but it's also part of storing knowledge as well. You know, the symbology is that thing that's missing from, modern accounting. And modern economics that sort of fails to notice the processes and the relations. And so therefore, you know, that those priorities and that sort of raft of perverse incentives ends up informing the entire structure of the system. And it's that structure that demands inequality, and it demands extraction, demands destruction. It is not our nature, and I'm sick of people suggesting that Lord of the Flies style. That somehow we're a flawed organism that must destroy. You know, we're not. We're operating within structures that have inequality baked into them. You know, none of us are, you know, xenophobic by nature. That's something that's just baked into the systems that we're trying to survive within. So, you know, we should go easy on ourselves and just identify the little leverage points in that system that where we can make change. And usually it's not in your discourse. You know, discourse is a good data set for analyzing where a system's at, but discourse analysis sort of causes us to ignore the structures, like the actual structures of the systems we inhabit. We think that if we can just collectively change our attitudes and raise our consciousness in some way, that that will change the system and the structure, but it won't. That's not what does it. But cataclysms are pretty good. They're pretty good at altering a structure a little.
Yeah.
You know, as long as there's enough of us there to leverage that cataclysm to offset the damage of the vulture capitalists who are doing the same, we'll be good.
So I guess now might be a good time to talk about the first law, which you referenced in the book, in that it might give some of the other themes we've just discussed some context in terms of Indigenous thinking. So the first law, based on my somewhat limited understanding, captures the idea that time and place are all the same thing, and that it is viewed as energy in motion in endless cycles of, as we said before, both collapse and renewal. Now, are you able to explain to our listeners how creation works in Indigenous thinking? And if we are to view the world in this way, how can we apply this knowledge today?
Oh, goodness.
yeah, it's a big one, I know. I know, you poor thing, you're tired.
Hey, can you just map out creation for us?
Yeah, Yeah, in a nutshell.
Yeah, in a nutshell. Yeah. Look, there's a thousand ways to do that, and there's a thousand different things to focus on. But essentially, in the end, there is a pattern to creation, and there are laws. There are natural laws that are there, and this is like so like the laws of physics. This is like the kindergarten level of the law of the land. These are the things that every person must understand. When you're going into a video game, you have to understand the physics of, how high a person can jump and all that sort of thing, the economy in there and everything else. And you learn that very quickly. If you can come into your actual real physical worlds in the same way, then you'll be fine. Gamify creation and you'll be right. That's a joke. But there are patterns to creation. Yeah, and there's always more than one variable. You can't say that something is caused by this. Oh, this is caused by this. So I'm with a team of researchers now that's isolated this one gene, that's responsible for the sort of spatiality and the symbolic meaning making that creates your maps of reality and the ability to see yourself in the world, with consciousness and everything. It's very exciting, but at the same time, I keep saying you can't just do. We're gonna have to get into epigenetics as well, because there's never just one variable. There are always lots of different. Selection pressures, etc. There's lots of co-evolutionary things always going on. Symbioses don't form from one cause.
Yeah.
And that's another natural law. There's all these natural laws there, and I don't know if you're keeping your eye on those things, the laws of thermodynamics, and just there's heaps of wisdom in what your granny told you when she said what goes up must come down. There's knowledge in that, and I guess to find the law of the land, you find those things, and there are always indicators for these things. And if you are open in place, and you're coming into an entity of a landscape, understanding that that's a sentient landscape, and that while you're in it, you're part of it, and you come into that sentience, and when you come into it in that way, it gives you things. The land gives you things all the time. It gives you everything that you need to be sheltered and fed and everything. And if it stops giving you that, it's probably telling you to leave. But it gives you knowledge as well, gives you information. And it is really something to be in communion with that. The only thing is, it doesn't really work on your own. If you're like a solitary wanderer, or, you've got a log cabin in the woods, that's not really going to work for you.
Why is that?
Well, for a start, you don't have the computational power to understand.
Yep.
The language of the land. On your own, you can only do that in groups with a collective, computational power. And you can only really come into that through ritual and, through, the daily practice of living together, being together in that place and coming into communion with that place together. That's how you have enough to be able to do it. Look, some of the old fellows can, because when you go through higher and higher stages of initiation, you're changed at this sort of spiritual and biochemical level, so that your mind becomes a supercomputer that's connected out to so many other entities.
You're attuned to that frequency.
Yeah, well, you're connected out to celestial totems and totems in the landscape and so many different things, that you have this kind of big distributed network of computational power that you can access without frying your brain like an egg. So that's how come your elders are so important, because they have the capacity to do that, and therefore they have the authority to guide people in the place. But they're not the boss either. That's important to know, because nobody's boss in our way.
Well, there's that symbiotic connection.
Power is distributed. Authority is held by people who have the knowledge and therefore the capacity to have authority, but power itself is distributed throughout the community, and everybody follows the guidance of the people who know, because why the hell wouldn't you? would be absolutely ridiculous to go off your own way. Why would you do that when you don't even exist as an entity on your own? Nothing can exist on its own, which comes back to that idea that there's never one variable, never one cause. And so when you start to see the patterns of how symbioses develop, how these amazing symbioses that you just can't imagine, you can't backward map that. You can't reverse engineer a symbiosis. You know, they all start out in parasitic relation, and then just miracles happen until you get these three completely interdependent things, or 10 interdependent things, or however many, whereby you can't pick up one of them without the rest of it, you know, coming with it. And that's what we try to do. We're not looking at those processes. We're not looking at the process of symbiosis. We're looking at the content. We try and pick up that butterfly and look at it, you know, under the microscope, under a looking glass, and we don't know because it's been removed. It's suddenly just a thing. It's not a process anymore.
Yeah.
And you can't learn very much by studying a thing. Your creation is yours to find. I'm not going to tell you what it looks like. Find it for yourself. But there are patterns.
Yeah.
There are patterns. And it's not this numerology thing and looking for things. Aha, that pizza shop's got a triangle on the side. That means there's pedophiles there. Yeah. And what's the street number? Oh, 665. All right, must be the next house along. You know, when you're following the patterns of creation, it is a rigorous process of inquiry. Take your time. Notice the laws. Notice, you know, if you're a software engineer, you might notice that there's always a trade-off between complexity and speed. You know, that whenever you increase the speed of an application or an algorithm or anything, then you decrease the complexity of that algorithm. You know, you always sacrifice diversity for efficiency. That's a natural law that anybody in computing would know. And a lot of people devote their whole careers to try and break that natural law. Or if we can overcome this, then we can have things that are really fast and really complex at the same time. It's like, dude, you can't. That's why you can't have zero point energy. Energy's got to come from somewhere. It's got to come from somewhere, and you always got to pay the bills. So just relax.
Yeah, and the whole thing is just following the breadcrumbs, that trust that you will end up where you need to be in the right place at the right time to translate the story that is for you to translate.
Yeah, that's it. I don't have any parting words of wisdom or anything like that. And I guess if you're looking for wisdom, you're looking in the wrong place. But, you know, if you're looking for a just a desire for inquiry that, you know, will guide you towards, you know, the processes that are going to, you know, get you what you need, not just what you want, then, you know, maybe that's something we can do together.
Oh, look, I've loved today's conversation. Thank you so much for your time, Tyson.
Sweet. Same way.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you would like updates on upcoming episodes as they are released, in addition to good news posts from the world of science and technology, please follow along at our Instagram page, which is at DNA of Purpose Podcast, or sign up to our newsletter at futurecrunch.com. You can also download our brand new ebook on the Great Transformation, which is available at our website. And these links are also included in the show notes. You can think of the Great Transformation document as your field guide to the next economy.